Blog Talk Radio.
Denise Griffiths is your partner in success. Tune in each Friday as virtual assistants, industry expert, web developer, and online entrepreneur Denise Griffiths interviews industry experts from one end of the internet to the other. These expert entrepreneurs freely share their business building knowledge and provide practical guidance that will show you how to build and grow your own very successful business, be it online or traditional brick and mortar. Now, ladies and gentlemen, your partner in success, Denise Griffiths.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm really excited today. I am welcoming to the program an expert on leadership, Mark Sanborn. I'm reading one of his books right now. We're going to talk about that, too. It's really a great book. Mark is the president of Sanborn & Associates, an idea studio dedicated to developing leaders in business and in life. He is also an international best-selling author, and noted authority on leadership, team building, customer service, and change. And Mark is here today to share some of his best ideas and thinking about how to pursue the extraordinary in both your business and in your life. Mark, good morning, and thank you so much. Welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Denise. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I am reading the I ordered this book from Tremendous Life Books a couple of weeks ago, The Encore Effect. I have to tell you, it's fascinating. I don't even know where to start. So if you don't mind, before I start peppering you with questions about the different things that you do, can you tell people who you are, where they can find you, and pretty much what you want to talk about today?
Well, I'd be glad to. Wow, that's a great blank check. What do I want to talk about today?
That's
great to have that kind of an opportunity. It's usually a lot more prescribed when I do interviews, so I'm looking forward to wherever the conversation takes us. I am a professional speaker, author, and advisor to leaders. I work in Denver, Colorado, actually the South Side, in a place called Lone Tree, Colorado. That's where our offices are at. And through the written word and spoken word and one-on-one interactions, our goal is simply to help people learn how to lead or lead better. And, of course, I believe that truth is transferable, that all principles apply. The only thing that ever changes is kind of the context. So the principles that we use primarily with Fortune 500 leaders and business people also apply in our personal lives as well. So I'm always very interested in that intersection between the personal and the professional. I don't really like that kind of false dichotomy, you know, that we're a different person at home than we are at work or in the community versus the marketplace. And the books that I write usually either flow out of my speaking or they kind of precede my speech offerings, because I do both. I write about what I talk about, and I talk about what I write about. And The Encore Effect, really, the book that you're now reading, came from a very simple idea, and that is, you know, how can you become the kind of person or the kind of employee or the kind of employer or the kind of company that people demand more of? You know, I think we live in an age where it's easy to be interchangeable, you know, where with a tough economy and unemployment at 8.3% last time I looked at the numbers, there are a lot of good people that are looking for work. And one of the things that I think can help us keep whatever job we already have is to make sure that our contributions are both unique and valued, so that if our organization says, wow, we're going to have to let some people go, I think the goal is to be the last person they want to let go, because they say, you know, Denise and Mark, wow, they just bring so much to their jobs. We really want to hang on to them if at all possible. And so The Encore Effect is really a blueprint for how to be an encore performer, whether you're in sales, whether you're in manufacturing, in law, healthcare, education, or for that matter, how to be the kind of person at home and in your friendships that people want more of.
I can't even tell you how much I agree with that. You know, when you have young children around or you're friends with people who have young children, you constantly hear this, they behave so differently at your house than they do at home. And that's, I hate to see that in children and in adults. To me, you should behave in life the way you, at home, the way you behave at business. You should treat people at home with the same respect that you treat people in business. And somehow that kind of gets lost, doesn't it?
Well, I agree, and I think the comment about kids is kind of good news and bad news. I mean, the good news is that usually means they're behaving better when they're in public or visiting a friend's home. But, of course,
that.
We all aspire to have well-behaved kids in either environment. I think one of the great tests of good parenting is also a test of leadership, and that is, do your employees, or if you're a parent, do your kids behave just as well in your absence as they do your presence?
Right.
I, many years ago, worked with an organization that had kind of a tyrannical leader. He was he always paid lip service to the fact that everyone was a professional and they didn't need to watch the clock. But, you know, the word on the street was, you better be there in the morning when he arrived and you better not leave until he left, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't work out well, because on the days that he was out of town, and people tended to know when he was going to be out of town because his assistant would circulate his schedule, those were the days people decided to come late, leave early, take long lunches, and generally goof around. You know, so lacking that kind of dictatorial authority, you know, that threat of this person finding out, people behave very differently. And I think a great environment is where people, whether they're being observed by their direct superior, whether a child is being watched by their parents, they do the right things for the right reasons. And that's really what education, leadership, and parenting is all about, is teaching people to do the right things and giving them reasons to do those things all the time.
Right. So I want you to talk about anything you want to talk about. I love your books. I know that you're a speaker. You're all over the place with your books and with your speaking engagements. And at some point, I would also like to talk, to chat about A Year of Success. And I think you already know this. I am a huge fan of A Year of Success. Huge.
Well, and I appreciate that, as does Larry and Sally and Bob. And I'll be glad to at some point during the show to talk about that, because I think it's a very effective tool for people who are students of life and students of leadership. You know, it's, as we can discuss later, it's not a get-rich-quick program. There are plenty of those out there if people are so predisposed. But our program is kind of a be-successful-always program. You know, it's about the fundamentals, the timeless truths, the principles of what it takes to live well and to increase success.
I know. And we will, you know, go into that into detail. Here's a question I have for you, though. And this is a quote by you. Nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary. On the face of it, that sounds like a simple declarative sentence. But you probably need to tell people what that really means and how they can kind of tap into that thought. Because some people, I think, just go, you know, I'm just me, I'm ordinary. You don't have to be ordinary, do you?
Well, it's a radical idea in that I think subconsciously most people think being extraordinary is a function of your upbringing, your environment, your circumstances. And certainly those things make it easier or harder to choose to be extraordinary. But at the end of the day, whether or not you're extraordinary is completely up to you. I tell people, you may work at a company that doesn't encourage it or support it, doesn't reward it, doesn't teach for it, but you can still choose to, despite those circumstances, bring an extraordinary focus and commitment and passion to your work. When I wrote The Fred Factor back in 2004, I was gratified that Tom Peters picked as one of his favorite, I think, 40 quotes of the year, a quote out of the book, which was slightly, only slightly different. And the quote in the book is, nobody can prevent you from choosing to be exceptional. And of course, exceptional and extraordinary are synonyms. But the point is that Tom resonated with the idea that too many people, I think, blame their lack of the extraordinary on external circumstances and other people. I have some friends, and I know we all know of people, we read about them, who've overcome terrible circumstances, raised in abject poverty, or who were the victims of terrible tragedies, who went on to become amazing people, not because of, but in spite of those things. You know, I think about my friend Chad Hymas in Salt Lake City, who was left a quadriplegic because of a farm accident, and today is one of the busiest and most successful speakers who tells audiences and is able to demonstrate through his own life that it's not about what happens to you in life. It's about what you do about it. And in many ways, and this is even a more radical idea, I think that our tragedies and setbacks make us better people. And I say people succeed not necessarily because of, but in spite of. In all reality, I think that even bad things and setbacks and tragedies should never be wasted on us, because they can propel us, to even greater levels of achievement.
I agree. We all have tragedies in our life, maybe a death of a spouse or a family member, a job loss, which can be a tragedy if you're teetering on the edge of, financial disaster. There are so many different things that happen to us, and I totally agree. How we view that circumstance and how we react to it and how we grow and evolve from it, I think really is what makes us the people that we can and should become. And to me, if life were easy, what in the heck kind of fun would that be?
Grief is an appropriate response to tragedy and setback. And
right.
There's a lot of unhappiness and dysfunction in the world because people were not willing to do the work of grieving, coming to terms with the tragedy or the setback. But there's a lot more tragedy in the world because people wallow in the past. They haven't done the grieving, or perhaps they stayed stuck there. And after a period of time, and it depends on the setback. I mean, there have been things that have taken me, months to get my head wrapped around, to come to terms with. But I eventually came to terms with it. The problem is when you meet people who talk about something that happened 40 years ago, and they're still bitter and angry about it. And that doesn't serve anyone well, least of all them. So I always tell people, grieving is a legitimate process, but wallowing in the misery isn't.
Do you have any tips for getting through grief? Because we all experience it, and we do have to get through it. We do have to recognize it, deal in it. Sometimes you have to just lay on the couch and eat bonbons, do whatever it takes. But at some point, you have to say, okay, I'm done. So do you have any tips that you may be able to share that will help people with that process?
There are a few things that have been helpful to me, and I'll just kind of run through this kind of short list that I hope will be helpful. The first is to make sure that as we're dealing with whatever unhappiness or grief that we're dealing with, that we don't do anything to add to it. I think we often justify, well, I need a drink, or I need to overindulge and overeat.
Right.
And before we know it, now we've got a double tragedy. What happened and the physical wreck we've made of ourselves trying to deal with it. So the first thing is, just from a very practical standpoint, is what you're doing adding to the pain? The second thing is there anything you can do to mitigate what happened? Every once in a while, something can happen that we can lessen the consequences if we take corrective action. It isn't just something that was frozen in time and that we can't address. And if there's something we can do, if there's amends we can make, if there's a change in direction we can take, then we need to do it. What happens is people sometimes get so paralyzed by the negative emotion, they ignore the possible action they can take, to mitigate whatever happened. The third thing is, if you can't mitigate it, as in you can't change it, then I think you have to come to the question, what can I learn from it? Because you've got to go forward. You can't go backwards. In 2008, I wrote about my book, Up, Down, or Sideways, a number of severe downturns I experienced, one in the stock market. And, I didn't, at that point, what was done was done. Like many people who were in the market at the time, damage was done. But I asked myself, going forward, what can I learn from this experience so I don't do it again? Or I protect against having that happen again. So I will say that one of the best questions you can ask is, what's the lesson here? Because, life puts you in courses you didn't sign up for. Nobody would sign up for, failed relationships 101 or financial devastation, the graduate level course. We end up in these courses sometimes, even though we've done our best, we sometimes end up in courses where bad things have happened. And so we got a choice. And the choice is, are we going to learn from the course, or are we going to languish in it? And I think until we learn, we probably don't fully get out of, we don't graduate, you know, we don't get to go to the next life course. So
right.
I think that's a logical question. What, if anything, can I learn from it? And then finally, I think we need to not focus exclusively on what's wrong, but we need to look at what's right. Because no matter how bad things are, and you know, I don't think there's any benefit in comparing bad stuff in life, you know, because there's always people that have it worse and there's always people that have it better. But the point is, I've never been at a point in my life, even at my deepest, darkest hour, that I still didn't have some things I could be truly and sanely appreciative and grateful for. And I think that's the other thing, is we change our focus exclusively to what happened or what went wrong or who wronged us, and we stop looking at the plethora of things that are still right and people who are still, you know, who we still love and love us in our lives.
And, you know, I think, and this has just been my experience, but I think when you're so focused on the misery that you find yourself in, you really kind of shut the door to other things, because you're just, it's like you're in a locked room. There's no window, there's no, you're just stuck. So
well, we
either
get stuck or we invite
it,
company. You know, the old misery loves company.
Yeah.
And we gravitate towards people who are miserable, I think in part because we're hoping they're more miserable than we are and we'll feel better by comparison. And I think that's why we like bad reality TV. You know, we watch TV shows, you know, Honey Boo Boo, which has got to be, you know, proof that our civilization is in decline.
I haven't seen it, but I agree with you. I've seen it.
I've seen it channel surfing, and it's voyeuristic TV that I think at some level makes you think, well, I guess my life's not as big a train wreck as their life is.
That poor little girl. I'll tell you, if I want to watch something and I watch very little TV, I just don't have the patience for it. Or the bandwidth, and I want to be entertained, or I want to be made to think. Those are the only two reasons I will watch TV. But you know who Reba McEntire is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had a program some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, called Reba. I love that show. It makes me laugh. There's a lot of family values in it. And if I'm just in the mood to, you know, just have a good giggle and laugh a little bit, I'll turn on Reba. That's about as far as I'm willing to go.
I'm with you. I think that anything we ingest intellectually, whether it's something we read or something we watch or something we hear, has the potential to entertain us and to educate us. However, I think we sometimes waste entertainment opportunities by, I mean, I think there's different kinds of entertainment. You know, there's uplifting entertainment, and there's you know, I'm struggling. I rarely am at a loss for words, but detrimental entertainment, you know, that
garbage entertainment.
Garbage in, garbage out. And then we wonder,
right.
I find it curious in our culture that we complain about lack of civility and bad manners among people and children, and yet the best viewed, the top shows on TV glorify bad behavior. Bad Girls Club, MTV, Jersey Shore. And, you know, people say, oh, is that judgmental? Damn right it's judgmental. As an adult, you have to be able to discern between good and bad, right and wrong. And because our culture has become so unwilling to discern or judge, we put stuff out there for general consumption that doesn't elevate our culture, doesn't educate people, and it actually reinforces bad behavior. And then we sit around and scratch our heads and have conversations in Congress and special hearings about the decline of American civilization. Frankly, it's not hard to figure out if you look at what most people consider entertainment today.
I agree. What do they call it, the MTV effect? I think pretty much everything on there is just pure trash. I don't have it. I don't watch it. But I'm aware of, and I agree with you, I'm aware of the decline in just our culture. I mean, our culture is
I'm still an advocate of free speech, but I think it's incumbent on us personally. If you disagree with it, I'm not suggesting you write a letter to your congressman to take it off TV, but you don't have to watch it. B,
Turn
you don't have to support it indirectly through buying products or services that are advertised on it. But C, importantly, to the degree you have influence on others, family members, kids, then you can encourage them to choose better. The mechanism, and it goes back to what was an earlier question about nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary. Nobody can prevent you from choosing to make better choices. But you have to come to terms with the fact that you only have 24 hours in a day, and how you spend those 24 hours are going to determine the person you become and the benefits or consequences you enjoy or suffer from.
You know, when I was a child, Mark, we were taught that leaders led by example. And the examples that are being set for children, for young adults, for... Look, I see, you know, I'm a political junkie, I admit it. And I spend a lot of time on Breitbart and you know, just different websites where I can get different opinions, different views, because I don't trust TV, the media, or any of it. But look, what I am finding is people are getting nastier by the day where they're making their comments. There doesn't seem to be, the ability for civil discourse seems to be circling the drain, and that worries me. You lead by
example.
Well, it
worries me too,
don't lead by
because we can no longer
somebody.
Yeah, we can't discuss and learn. What we typically do, it happens more often than not, is we label a name call. It's not
right.
Dialogue. It's vitriolic. You state an opinion, and instead of someone saying, I feel differently and here's why, they call you an expletive and a hater.
Mm-hmm.
That is the biggest cop-out. If you disagree with someone, you can totally end any kind of engagement by calling them a hater. You believe that? You must be a hater. How about you just believe differently? I am not threatened by people with a different point of view, but I'm annoyed by people who don't know why they have a different point of view.
There you go.
People who cannot defend intellectually. You know, you say you're going to vote for, you know, somebody from outer space. You better be able to explain why, even if I don't agree that the outer space candidate is the candidate for me, you owe it to yourself and your country to understand why you believe what you believe. And the reality is right behind the decline of civil discourse is the decline of thinking. We want to be spoon-fed.
Mm-hmm.
I've read, you know, with this upcoming election, I read on both parties so many people that say things like, well, I've been told, or I've heard, or somebody said. What kind of credible evidence is that?
I know. And the ubiquitous, well, they said, really?
Yeah, the old mysterious they.
Yeah, I mean, they've been around since I was a kid. Well, they said. And even as a kid, I was like, point them out to me. I want to know who they are. You're right. There is a tremendous decline, I find, in just our culture and in our ability to learn. And that's why I think books like yours are so, so important. I'm a political junkie, and I am a voracious reader. I've got over 3,000 books. I've got two Kindles. To me, reading is one of the most important things somebody can do. But is that, in your experience, are people reading more and learning more out of school, perhaps, you know, from people like you and Larry Wingate and, Don DeScamacci and people? I mean, what is your experience? What are you noticing when you're out there in the world?
It's pretty evident from the data that I've seen that there is a decline in the number of people buying books and the number of books being bought. Now, that, as a guy who's trained as an economist, I can tell you that cause and correlation are two different things. You could reasonably infer from that if people are buying less books, people are reading less. Even though the medium is changing, you know, now more books for the first time, and you know, more fiction books were sold on Kindle in e format than they were in hard copy. So people are still reading. And by the way, a lot of people buy books and never read them. You know, I often, when I was in selling in corporate America, I learned never to ask an executive about a book on their bookshelf because, regrettably, they often bought it but didn't read it, and you would embarrass them. If you mentioned the book, hey, what did you think of? Well, I haven't got to that yet. Well, you know, and it's a book that was published, you know, 6 years earlier. But what I think is happening is, and you know, like-minded people always gravitate towards like-minded people. So people who are readers, people who believe in the importance of not just the emotional life but the intellectual life, are always looking for good ideas, whether they be through the books or through the internet, or through classes, or wherever, whatever medium you choose. But I do think we have become, and I don't have the hard data to prove this, so I'll just say my belief is we have become culturally ADD, you know, the soundbite rules. It's harder and harder for people, you know, if you read The Shallows or any number of commentaries, it's harder and harder for people to focus on complex ideas and do the real work of thinking because they're used to everything in 140 characters or less. And as you know, Denise, I use Twitter because I like to disseminate ideas in as many different avenues as I can. Mm-hmm. But if the only information you're getting is in a Twitter feed, you're going to have a very limited intellectual life.
No kidding. Well, here's the thing about books too. And now, you know, I will not read fiction. I just read very little fiction. It just doesn't grab me. I like history. Well, when I just lied. I love murder mysteries. I kill off more people in my sleep than I can even think about. But to me, they make me think. You know, I love a good whodunit. But other than that, I'm reading business books and I love history books. You know, I love anything that's going to make me think, you know, it's going to engage my brain. But here's the thing, you can also, a lot of books, my business books, going back to what you're talking about, the medium is changing. An awful lot of my business books now I get at audible.com because I can listen while I work. So
no,
to
I
me,
think that's a great alternative.
Great.
I'm a news junkie in the morning. I get up early and exercise, and that's where I usually get my news feed. And what I've found is that about 80% of the news that you'll see in newspapers, whether it's the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, or your local city's newspaper, has been covered by a CNN or a Fox or whatever the local news is. And so within about a half hour in the morning, I can usually get kind of the big themes for what's going on in the world. But then for me, the goal is to have an ongoing stream of good and positive ideas, meaning both useful, and I'm not, if you read Up, Down, or Sideways, my last book, I am not the guy who says stop reading the newspaper. That drives me crazy, and I've got some great friends who say, you know, don't read the newspaper, it's only full of the negative. Well, if you're going to be informed, you need to know what's going on. And just because you didn't read about real estate prices dropping doesn't mean that your house isn't worth less. So if you're planning on buying or selling a house, you probably ought to pay attention to real estate values. And frankly, it's not always going to be good news. So I tell people the key is to be both informed and inspired. Get the information you need, but add to that or complement that with positive, uplifting, motivational philosophy, theology, just good, positive thinking. And then you've got, you know, you've got a double-edged sword. You're both informed and inspired.
Why is that bad?
Pardon?
A double-edged sword, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No,
I've always
I'm glad you clarified my metaphor.
I've always looked at a double-edged sword as being, oh my gosh, you're going to get smite with either end of it, and you know,
you're going to smite ignorance with both sides of the sword.
Okay.
Let's build that out a little bit. Let's say it's a double benefit. You know, I don't think it's enough to be informed, but I also don't think it's enough to be just inspired.
Right. I agree with you. Yeah, and you're talking about the different things that you can do. You know, I mean, I look at some TV commercials, and I don't look at them so much as I'm passing through the kitchen, and one will come on in the living room, and it might grab my attention. And there's one that I detest. I can't tell you how much I detest it. And I think it's Volvo, or it's a foreign car, and it's got Charlie Sheen in it with an ankle bracelet. That is one of the slimiest commercials I can think of. But I watched it, and I came away with a great idea for a blog. So it had its upside.
What's that?
The blog? I haven't written it yet. It's being written. But, you know, basically, when you look at that, you've got this guy who is a drug addict. He's just a slime ball, in my opinion. And he jumps out of this car. He drives this car into a gorgeous mansion, you know, slides it all over the floor, and then steps out with his ankle bracelet like he's to be proud of that. I'm sorry.
Well, it goes back to what we talked about earlier, and that is, you know, glorifying bad behavior. And somebody, you know,
really
I came out of advertising, and one of the things I learned in advertising is subtlety usually doesn't work. You know, you have to use a blunt object to get people's attention. And the reality is somebody did some demographic research that says this demographic that might buy whichever car it's advertising relates to Charlie Sheen. I wish that we, all of us, myself included, this is not pointing a finger, but I think it's pretty important to the future of our culture. We ought to start asking the question, not can we do it, but is it the right thing to do? Because there's a lot of things you can do that are legal, you know, but they don't enrich, they don't add to the positive side of the ledger. But we somehow have just rationalized so much bad behavior in the pursuit of profit. And I'm a capitalist. I mean, I'm an unabashed capitalist. I believe capitalism is an imperfect but the best system of doing business in the world. And so I don't have a problem with profit. I am a capitalist with a conscience, and I think that the money we make has to be tempered against how we make the money. And if you make money by putting pablum and crap on TV, you're going to be very profitable and have a lot of advertisers, but you got to wonder if at your retirement party you're going to look back with glowing pride and go, wow, we really changed the world with that bad behavior show that we produced.
Absolutely. There's so much of what I see anymore that make, look, my eyebrows are permanently hitting my hairline these days. I'm like, what? What in the world is that?
Yeah, me too.
I give myself a headache.
My forehead disappearing.
Yeah. I tell you, I do a lot of eye rolling. I have a championship belt in eye rolling these days. There's very little of what I see going on around me that makes me go, wow, that is seriously cool. Most of me is going, you have got to be kidding me. And that's not a good reaction. But I want
I think we're all faced with this basic question. If, you know, I mean, it's easy. We all do it. We complain and talk about what's wrong. I think, though, the real question is, so what do we have? What can we do? I mean, what's our response other than to decry it? And I think the answer isn't to try to stop it, because I don't, you know, like I said, what's legal and what's right are often two different things. I think our choice is to offer an alternative in the way we do business, in the way we are employers or employees. I don't think we try to change the world by just righting the wrongs, but by giving people an alternative. And I think when a company does that through the aesthetics of their product, like Apple, or through, you know, the experience that a great hotel like the Ritz-Carlton or a Marriott offers. I think that stands in stark contrast to the kind of mediocrity or the lack of excellence that we see in so many areas. And so, you know, we can get philosophical all day long, but the question is, what do we do, what can we do to combat this? And the answer is we can be exceptions to the rule. We can choose advertising if we are advertisers that is noble and enriching instead of base and derogatory. When we dialogue, we can be civil and we can offer insights and be open-minded to other opposing points of view rather than name-calling and labeling. It's about just choosing to be exceptional by being different in the right way.
I love how you said that. That is, I'm actually going to have this transcribed so I can write that out. I want to go back a little bit, just a little bit. We were talking about the Fred Factor. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because I know the Fred Factor was an international bestseller. And, you know, you kind of share the secrets of extraordinary individuals who have learned how to reinvent themselves in their work. And that's kind of what we've been talking about. So can you chat a little bit about that?
I'd be glad to. I just am finishing the final edits on Fred 2.0, which is actually the sequel. The Fred Factor, with the subtitle, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary, that came out in 2004. It sold, and the only reason we don't know exactly is because in about a dozen different countries where the book's published, reporting numbers aren't always accurate or up to date, but we know the book sold somewhere north of 2 million copies, almost a million here in the U.S., some 800,000 plus in China, and then another, you know, a dozen countries. And the reason I say that is not to brag, but simply because the principles transcend culture. And the Fred Factor is about an extraordinary individual who delivers the mail. His name is Fred Shea. He still delivers mail in Denver, Colorado. And he's got what could be a pretty redundant job, putting mail in a box. I mean, he walks, when I met him, he was walking a route. Now he delivers in office buildings and apartment buildings. But, I mean, think about it. Sorting and putting mail in a box, most people would say, not the most exotic, way to make a living. But Fred made it artistry. I mean, the guy just, and if people want to read the story from the book, they didn't have to buy the book, they can go to marksanborn.com/Fred Factor Story. Or they can just go to the website, fredfactor.com. And they can read the story, because it's not a long story, but really time doesn't allow me to do it justice here. And so what I did is I wanted to write a book based on using Fred as an example, a real-life example, of what I believe business philosophy should be. Interestingly enough, the book, I think, is seen as a customer service book, and that's fine, because one of the things I learned as a marketer is don't ever argue with your customer about what they think your product is. And if they think it's a customer service book, God bless them as long as they buy it and read it, right?
Take it to heart.
Yeah, I mean, I learned that from Trout and Rees in their book, Positioning, The Battle for the Mind. Don't argue with your customer. What they think it is, it is. So the book talks about four principles that I think apply to all businesses and life, for that matter, but in particular, certainly it applies to customer service. And that is, that everyone makes a difference. There's no neutral. I hear people say, "Well, I'm not making a positive difference, but I'm keeping my nose clean. I'm following the rules. I'm neutral." And frankly, when we meet neutral people, we don't think of them as neutral. We think of them as indifferent. They don't care enough to engage us. They don't care enough to help us. They don't care enough to hustle. I think that at a very practical level, the only question at the end of the day is, what kind of difference did you make? Did you enrich somebody's life? Did you diminish it? Did you build them up? Did you tear them down? Did you move the ball down the field for your employer? Did you take a loss? I just think that we're better served at a very practical level. I'm not arguing philosophy here, but to realize that neutrality is pretty much a myth. We all make a difference. And the question is, what kind? And once you realize that, you start choosing to make a positive difference every day instead of just accidentally doing it, which rarely happens. You rarely change the world accidentally. Mother Teresa didn't accidentally change the world. You do it with intentionality. So number one, everybody makes a difference. Number two, it's all built on relationships. I mean, what separates an ordinary service provider from a great service provider is the quality of the relationship you have with the people who provide the service. And, relationship building is tough. We're not taught how to do it. I've rarely run into a course, Relationship Building 101, and yet it's what we're supposed to be doing in business, building relationships with colleagues and customers and vendors. And so in the book, I talk about, at a very easy level, how do you do that? How do you build better relationships? And then the third principle is you can add value to everything you do. You can, and this kind of circles back to the Encore effect, where I say, is the product or service you provide better because you provide it? Because if you're providing a product or service that a computer or another employee or any other employee could provide, then you're at risk because you're not adding value to the process. And we like people who add that little bit of a flourish or that little bit of extra. It's why when you go to a good restaurant, you don't just want to eat at the good restaurant, but if you've got a favorite waiter or waitress, you want to sit in their section because that their familiarity with you and your likes and their conversational ability and their attention is going to make the food, which is consistent throughout the restaurant, even better in terms of your dining
experience. Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's always about the experience. And that's actually one of the tenets from the new book. The new book, which comes out in March next year, one of the tenets is elevate the experience. To kind of take a holistic look at all the things you do to basically say, and I talk about the components of an elevated experience, do people leave happier? Are they pleasantly surprised? Mm-hmm. Do they receive value? Because that's what an elevated experience is. And then finally, from the Fred Factor, I talk about number four is you can reinvent yourself every day. The only difference, as the old cliche goes, between a rut and a grave is distance and depth. A lot of people are in ruts, doing the same thing they've always done. And it's possible to, we all know people that died at 38 and they're still upright at 55. You know, I mean, they're biologically sentient. You know, they're carbon-based life forms, and they're still mobile, but they haven't done anything different in the last 20 years. And not only are they bored to death, but they're boring the living daylights out of everybody else.
The oldest person I ever met in my life, and this was when I was in my 20s, and I still knew that this guy was just the walking dead. He was only 39 or 40, maybe, and I thought he was so elderly. I mean, I have never met an older man in my life.
Yeah,
I mean,
age is much more mindset than it is chronological.
Yeah, it was horrible. And he still pops into my head every now and then as the single most boring person I've ever met in my life.
Yeah, it's funny.
A very nice man. Very nice man. But, oh, my God, when I saw him coming, I would run for the hills.
World weary, yeah. The weight of the world had probably taken its toll on him. You know, many, many years ago, it was at least, I don't know how many years Denver International Airport's been open, but I was flying out of Stapleton, and I was in the Red Carpet Club, and I saw Keith Richards. It had to be at least 20 years ago. And Keith Richards looked, I mean, let me just diplomatically say, he had lived a hard rock and roll lifestyle. And
he looks like he slept in his face. He does.
Yeah, he's pretty cadaverish. I mean, he's pretty roadworthy. This was 20 years ago, and yet if you follow rock music or if you read his book, the guy's an avid reader. He's obviously member of arguably the greatest rock and roll band of all time, or at least one of them. He's got a great intellectual life, and he's got a lot of vitality. So there's kind of the reverse. You know, the guy certainly looks, even then he looked old, but the guy's vibrant. You know, so it's not about appearances. It's not about chronological age. It's about what kind of energy do you bring to your life every day? What kind of energy do you bring the world? I mean, because that is your life. And so we don't want to grow old before our time.
No. And going back to Fred, I have to say, I live in a small village. You know, I'm equidistant between Katrina and Rita in Louisiana. Like, there's still sugarcane fields on two sides of my little tiny housing development here. My mail lady is the sweetest woman that you can ever meet. And one day I stuck it, because we have our little mailboxes down by the road, and I stuck a letter in there with a little note, and I said, I don't know if I need extra postage. Can you just kind of eyeball this and let me know if I need to stick another stamp on it? She wrote a little note and put it back in there. She said, I'll take it to the post office and take care of it for you. Don't worry about it. So she put extra postage on it for me. So then I wrote on Facebook, because she's just so accommodating. She really is. Now, you talk about boring. She's driving around southwest Louisiana, her little truck, probably doesn't see many people during the day. And she delivers everything with such joy and such aplomb. She'll bring packages up to my door, do a little cheery knock on the door because she knows that my office is here. She doesn't want to bother me. And just give me a little tap-tap to let me know something's on my doorstep, and off she goes. So I, caught up with her one day and said, I want to bake you some cookies. What do you want? She said, chocolate chip. I made her chocolate chip cookies. I put them in the mailbox. She put a printed prayer in the mailbox for me. I don't know too many people who will do that kind of thing.
Well, I want to comment because there's
so many
good lessons that come out of that story. And the first is that, being a Fred, whether you use that phraseology or not, but being that kind of a person is
a
virtuous cycle.
She was great.
She did a great job. You recognized that she appreciated it, which made her do a better job, which made you appreciate her more. That's a virtuous cycle versus the vicious cycle where you leave a note in the mailbox, it's ignored, then you dislike the postal carrier for not being helpful.
Right.
They don't get any cookies. Since they don't get any cookies, they don't feel like being helpful. I just called I bought one of those kind of Groupon-ish coupons for a helicopter ride for my wife and I, just something fun to do. And I called a week ago to schedule it, and I got this message that said, all operators are busy. As far as I know, they may not even have any operators. They may just have a voicemail system, and they're just trying to fool you. And they said, but if leave a message, we'll call you back within 24 or 48 hours. That was like 5 days ago. No callback. So I called today. I held. I finally succumbed to the leave a message, and I said, I left a message a few days ago. I have not heard back from anybody because I was trying to create a sense of urgency, like, and not be a snot about it, but it's really kind of off-putting to have given someone money and not get a call back. And I'm thinking, what's going to happen is they're going to go, oh, yeah, you jerk. You had to mention. You left a message. We didn't call you back. Well, we'll fix you. We won't call you back this time either. And it has that classic potential, you know, to be that vicious cycle, right?
Right.
Instead of the person calling back and going, wow, we got your message. We'd love to schedule it for you. We're really appreciative that you bought the coupon, blah, blah, blah. And that's the second point I want to make. It's not the job you have. It's how you do the job. You know, I meet people that say, oh, you know, I got to get a better job. Well, that may be. But I'll say, before you get a better job, why don't you do the job you have better? Before you get a different job, why not do the job you have differently?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, it's not just the job. It's how you do it. And Fred is a world-class example of a guy that made the app, made more than the most. He reinvented what it means to be a postal carrier.
I have to get that book. I have to admit, I don't have that one. I am getting it, and I'm going to give it to Faye, who is my mail carrier. I'm getting one for her.
When the show's over, send me your mailing address. I'll make sure we hook you up. All right.
Oh, thank you. Because
that's one nice thing about interviewing the author. I got connections here. I just have to walk to the other side of my office and pick up a copy for you.
Very. Thank you. I appreciate it. She will love it. I mean, thank you so much.
You bet.
Okay, so going back, I mean, you know, we're straying way off course. I've got so many questions I have for you. I'm looking at the clock going, oh, gosh, we're running out of time, but we're just going to make this work. So Fred is a great, great starting point. Do you find that people, are they really kind of paying attention, particularly in there's so much angst going on in the world. Here's what I'm noticing, and I'm kind of scattered around because my brain is firing on all four neurons right now. With the moral decline and, you know, the decline of what I am seeing, I'm seeing that people are experiencing kind of, the only way I can describe it, is a low-level sense of dread on a daily basis. So do you think that this is a very good time for them to kind of step out of that dread and that cycle of, well, you said and I said and she said, and just lead by example? Do you see that people are starting to maybe realize that what they've been doing just doesn't work?
Well, certainly some are. I'm at an age where I'm rarely surprised. I mean, I can still be disappointed, but I'm rarely surprised at what I see. But I think that if there's anything good that can come, I wrote an article, my last e-zine that I'm going to run as a blog, called "Even Tough Times Can Hold Good Reminders." You know, we can always find good in even the worst situations, and I hope that I would hope that people would start to understand, for instance, that however you vote in the upcoming election, the question isn't, are you better off? The question is, will we be better off?
Right.
One of the things that's tearing at our nation is this sense of the navel as the center of my political universe. And if I'm not better off, by golly, then you're going to pay. Or if I don't get better off because of what you're promising, we got to do what's best for the country, you know. And everybody talks about sacrifice, and they usually talk about somebody else doing it.
No kidding.
Well, you know, you need to sacrifice. I don't need to sacrifice. I go crazy at kind of the illogic that we bring to the whole discussion around all those political hot potatoes. But the question is not, are we or am I better off? Are we better off? Vote for the person that you in good conscience think will make America better off. I'm not going to politicize who or why I think that is, but that's to me the question. And so we also have to go back to this idea, and I can share this with my clients, and I'll share it with your listeners at no cost today. Nobody's going to do it for you. Stop waiting for the tooth fairy. Stop waiting for the good Samaritan. There are good Samaritans. There are people who will help you and encourage you. But I'm like Dennis Miller. I'll paraphrase because what he said isn't quite suitable for airplay. But he said, we want to help the helpless, but we don't give a darn about the clueless.
Agreed. And this cradle to welfare stuff is killing our country. It is perverting human nature.
You know, people don't understand that the same laws of economics apply at a national level at your household level.
Mm-hmm.
If you spend more money than you have, you are technically bankrupt. Yeah. And it doesn't matter, you know, people say, well, so-and-so, such-and-such a president had a bigger budget, ran up a bigger deficit. I don't give a rat's behind. I'm talking about today and going forward. We got a big problem that a whole lot of people, Republican and Democrat, both parties contributed to. So is that a good reason to perpetuate it? Well, somebody else did. That's like somebody saying, somebody else broke my leg, so you can go ahead and break my leg, too.
Oh, gosh. Good point.
I mean, that's the kind of stark reality that I think most people tend to miss, you know, and I hope there's a revival. If there's a revival, I hope we have a twofold revival. I hope we have a sense of camaraderie. We're in this together. And by the way, I hate to tell you, Denise, but probably the one thing that would reunite us is if something really bad happened, like what happened on 9/11. Because for a brief period of time, we stop bickering about stupid stuff and we start looking at taking care of each other. The other thing is I'd like to see a revival in taking responsibility for your life. I don't know who came up with the idea that if someone is successful, they somehow exploited you to do it. When I was a kid, I grew up in a lower middle class family on a farm where we worked in the field 8 or 10 hours a day, and I saw wealthy, successful people, and I didn't despise them. I wanted to find out how they did it so I could do it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where did that go? I genuinely don't understand how people can stand around and say, well, you know, you made this. I've had this happen to me, Mark. At the time I drove a Mercedes, I was in the parking lot. This was right after the last election. I was in a parking lot at a grocery store. And I had seen this woman carry out, I mean, she had 2 buggies worth of food, really good food, and she paid with it with her food stamp card. I didn't say anything. I didn't like it, but I didn't say anything. She goes out to the parking lot, and then she went into the McDonald's and ate a lunch there. Still none of my business. But then she goes out to her car, which was a similar car to mine, but older. And darned if she didn't try to attack me in the parking lot about, you know, you're not supposed to be driving those SUVs. And I looked at her, and I listened to her for a while, and then I told her what I thought. She didn't like it. And
yeah, arrogance and ignorance is a tough combination to beat. I heard Les Brown say that many years ago. And
yeah.
It's bad enough that she misses the irony.
She did, big time.
But then,
and I was paying for her food.
You know, I'm like you. It's like, I may not agree with you, but I, it's not my business. I don't need to interject my beliefs into your life. But then you have people who then, in some kind of unfair turnabout, do the same to you.
It was bizarre. It really was. And I listened to her very patiently. And then I told her just exactly how the corn grew, without cursing, without raising my voice.
Right.
And I told her precisely what I thought of her logic, what I thought of her lifestyle, and what I thought about paying for her lifestyle. She didn't like it none. I didn't care.
You know, here's another, since we're in the political phase, here's another thing people don't understand. It's not the government's money. It's our money.
It's our money. Yeah.
And if you are in the 50% of Americans who pay some taxes, keeping in mind that 50% of Americans who pay no taxes get to vote on the rest that do.
Which they
shouldn't
be allowed.
If you're in the 50% of Americans who pay taxes, it ain't the government's money. I'm amazed at how many people think the government has its own pocketbook, has its own bank account.
Mm-hmm.
It's the money that businesses and individuals and sales tax provides it. So we all have a vested interest. It's kind of like I don't say to my kids, hey, Dad, just put a check in the bank, go out and spend it as you will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm responsible for earning it and for spending and investing it. Therefore, let's stop acting like the government is an independent entity, unaccountable to us because they got their own checking account. It's called your money.
Tax money. That's exactly right. And I'm seeing now, I saw a little bit of it this morning while I, like you, I get up in the morning and I exercise and I was on my rebounder, and, you know, I hear people saying that they, you know, any corporations that make excess money should be taken away from them. My jaw dropped. Like, you have got to be kidding me. How can you be that ignorant? It's really frightening.
Well, what is excess money? It's called profit. By the way, I think the clip you saw, it was ludicrous, where they ask people about if profit should be capped or eliminated from corporations.
Yeah,
and,
that was the
sheeple
exactly.
All said, yeah, oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? That's where taxes come from. If a company makes no profit, there are no taxes. So if you're inane and silly enough to believe that company shouldn't make any money, then you're inane and silly enough to believe that there should be no taxes, which then begs the question, so how do we finance our nation? It is through profit that companies grow and hire more people and do research and development. Without a profit motive, there would be nobody looking for a cure for cancer or coming up with the pharmaceutical advances that have allowed us to increase our life expectancy. But again, it's just one of those emotional knee jerks. You know, it's what happens when you miss Economics 101 or when you sleep through class. You got to understand.
You don't learn history.
Basic.
You
got to understand history.
You have to understand history.
And you got to understand economics. And the two are pretty closely entwined, by the way.
They are. They absolutely are. And, you know, we're not talking just about politics for those who are kind of following along with us. These impact our daily lives. I mean, how we make these decisions politically and social, you know, so in our economy, our home economy, everything else, these are all very important things for us to think about and to understand, mostly to understand. So, I mean, these do absolutely impact how we make our own decisions at home.
Yeah, ideas have consequences.
And in business. Yeah.
They do. And I think that we have a great responsibility to think clearly. You know, we don't have to be geniuses. We don't have to be PhDs. But
right.
we need to think clearly and we need to think well. Because the quality of our thinking determines the quality of our actions, and that determines the results we enjoy in our lives.
I agree. And, you know, we really need to just stop bullying each other, which, you know, and I realize that that's, you know, kind of bonged around a good bit. People, oh, you know, this is bully, bully, bully. I will listen to the opposing, like you, I will listen to the opposing point of view. You may never sway me, but it's your point of view, and I'll listen until you poke a finger in my chest. At that point, you better back up. But, you know, I'll listen.
Yeah. I agree. I just don't think that, and that's why, you know, if any of your listeners follow me on Facebook or Twitter, I rarely post anything even remotely political because
not because I don't
think ideas about that are important, but because I know that the chances of any kind of a positive dialogue resulting from that are so slim that it's just not the medium. I did put on one of my Facebook pages the other day the simple question: do you think that political Facebook postings change anybody's vote? And, you know, kind of the consensus was, for any number of reasons, not really. I mean, we're preaching to the converted. Most of your friends on Facebook are your friends because they think like you think. So when you put something up that's pro anything, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, most of your friends are going to say, yeah, amen, brother, amen, sister. So, and the other thing is in a short post, frankly, you're not going to really be able to unpack the nuances of most of the important issues of the day in a two-sentence post. So that's why I don't do it. Although I did post about the Tooth Fairy. You know, this was in USA Today a few days ago. The Tooth Fairy now is paying $3 per tooth. That's up 15% from last year. And I said, why are neither candidate addressing this dramatic inflationary increase in tooth payments? And I said, you know, my favorite post was one guy said, I think the solution is to take the healthy teeth of children who brush and floss and don't eat candy and give to the unhealthy kids who eat candy and don't brush. I mean, you talk about a nice little metaphorical point of view there. You know, that was as close to a heated political exchange as that blog or that post created.
Well, you know, you, of course, are friends with Larry Winget, and I'll go visit his page, and, boy, he can get into it with some people, and I love it. But here's the thing with Larry, like you and I, he doesn't argue with them. He listens to them. But when it comes time to say, look, you know, you kind of stepped off the edge of the road there, he'll tell them. Yeah. But there's a lot of chat over there. And speaking of, and we, I cannot believe we're out of time. This was the fastest darn hour. Tell people where they can find you on the Internet, and we want to cover A Year of Success very quickly, too.
Well, yes, thank you. It's easy to find me. My name is my website, marksanborn.com. I have four websites, and all of my social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, are all accessible through marksanborn.com. So rather than try to give people a lot of information they can't remember. And there's also, if they go to marksanborn.com, I think it's free. It's on the homepage. I have about 15 or 20 webinars and special reports and just resources, because I'm a big believer that if people find value in your ideas, you know, for free, that they'll consider investing in your ideas, you know, for fee. So I offer that as kind of a value add. A Year of Success, fabulous, and Denise, you're an affiliate, so you definitely share with listeners your affiliate link. But what we did is four of us that are close friends who respect each other's work, Larry Winget, myself, Larry and I go back over 20 years, Bob Berg and Sally Hogshead recorded 52 3 to 4 minute videos. And at the end of each video, you get a PDF with 2 actionable ideas. And it's straight ahead. It's simple but not simplistic. It's time-proven. I mean, between the four of us, we've written any number of best-selling books, given literally thousands of speeches. We've distilled our best ideas into a way to systematically keep improving your life, both your business, your professional life, and your personal life. And it's been very gratifying, A, to team up with people that I greatly respect and truly like and love as human beings, but B, to be able to offer people something that I know has value, that it's not get rich quick, but it's something that will truly, if applied, help them live better lives.
It will. And, you know, we're talking about our morning routine. I'm an early riser. It sounds like you are as well. I get up in the morning. I hit my little – I have half of my garage is my gym, and then I've got my rebounder in the living room because I love that thing. I mean, I jump around like a little kid, and I giggle and just have fun. But my routine in the morning is like you to grab the news, and then I come into my office, and the first thing I do, you know, I have dual monitors. On one monitor, I'm loading my Gmail. On the other monitor, I'm logging into a Year of Success. Every day. And I'm, you know, I will go back and I'll look at something. I'll watch one of your videos. And anybody who knows me knows that I detest videos. You've got to get my attention quickly. These are small, they're short, they're pertinent. I mean, they're bite-sized chunks. So I'm willing to watch them and I enjoy them. But a lot of times, this is what I find, Mark. I'll go, let me go back and revisit that one. Because every time I watch something by any one of you, I pick up another nugget that is pertinent to that day, that point in my life. You know, I'll hear the same thing, but I hear it differently and go, wait a second. And I have an aha moment just darn near every day.
Well, I appreciate hearing that because I'm like you. I think, you know, re-listening and rereading, if it's good, you know, can always give us new insights.
Exactly, exactly. I cannot believe we are absolutely out of time, and I thank you so much for being with me here today. I had a ball, and if you would like to come back, I would love to have you back as a guest.
Oh, my pleasure. It was great fun, and I would love to come back, and I hope that people will check out my website, learn more about what I do, and hopefully some of them who do what I do, I'll learn more about what they do as well. But it's been a treat, and it's been great to be with you, Denise.
Well, thank you, Mark. Well, listen, everybody, this is Denise Griffiths and Mark Sanborn, and we are wishing you a wonderful weekend, and I will see you next week. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.